Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
I only recently learned about how my grandparents came to the U.S. We were in my grandma's kitchen, where a lot of our family conversations happen. While stirring a pot of sauce on the stove, my grandma May, who we called Mimi, told us how her parents, Natale and Angelina, immigrated from Sicily to Buffalo, New York in the early 1900s. They came to America for the promise of opportunity, but their stories look a lot like almost everyone else who passed through Ellis Island. Once they got here, they faced heavy discrimination. Mimi said every Sunday they would cook a rich meat sauce, similar to the one she was making us that night, which smelled so fragrant and delicious, it filled the entire house. But back then, their family would make sure all the windows stayed tightly locked so the neighbors wouldn't smell it and know how Italian they really were. I'm Bianca Taylor, in for Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. My grandma Mimi met and married another Italian immigrant, my grandpa Joe. He told us when they were looking for a place to live in Buffalo in the 40s, he almost changed their last name from Adornetto to Adri because no one would rent to someone whose last name ended in a vowel. Italian immigrants would experience a different kind of discrimination decades later here in California. In the early 1940s, while more than 100,000 Japanese Americans were being sent to incarceration camps, 10,000 Italian citizens living in California were forced to relocate. One of those displaced families was Becca Gulardi's grandmother. Becca was surprised when her grandmother told her the story of how she was forced from her California home during World War II.
It was sort of with that, wait, why did you have to move across town kind of thing? And then she said, oh, it was because we were Italians. And then we kept prompting her with questions to say, what do you mean it was because you were Italian?
Today on our show, we look at why the Italian experience during World War II was so different in California. KQED producer Pauline Bartoloni's ancestors also immigrated from southern Italy to New York, and she investigated this story for an episode of KQED's podcast, Bay Curious. Pauline takes the story from here.
To start investigating this question about how Italians were treated in California during World War II, we went straight to the source, Grandma. Becca Gulardi's grandma, that is.
Well, my name is Laura Neri Gulardi. I'm 90 years old. I was born and grew up in Santa Cruz, California.
Laura Gulardi now lives in Salinas. It was her father, Quinto Neri, who came to California in 1911 from Tuscany in northern Italy. He was one of millions of Italians who came to the U.S. for a better life. Many stayed in urban centers like New York City, but others ventured farther to California, becoming fishermen, working in agriculture, and the wine industry.
And he came at age 17 because they were starving. It was a large family. He knew some people in San Francisco who sponsored him, and so he went to work in Half Moon Bay.
Laura's dad farmed Brussels sprouts and built a life for himself. He bought some land and a house. But then the Second World War hit, and Italy declared war on the United States. Suddenly, Laura's dad went from starting to achieve a middle-class life to being labeled enemy alien.
This war is a new kind of war. It is different from all other wars of the past.
The President of the United States at the time, Franklin Roosevelt, gave military commanders and other officials sweeping rights to protect the homeland after the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. That's what led to the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans. And since Italy and Germany had also declared war on the U.S., new restrictions applied to their citizens living here.
We shall give up conveniences and modify the routine of our lives if our country asks us to do so.
Italian citizens had to register as enemy aliens, and many were subject to an 8 p.m. curfew. They couldn't travel more than 5 miles away from home. People's houses were searched for so-called contraband, things like cameras and radios. People who violated the new rules could be arrested.
Remembering that the common enemy seeks to destroy every home and every freedom in every part of our land.
Italians on the West Coast were hit hardest by the new restrictions. The military forced Italian citizens, mostly living on the Pacific coastline, to find new homes. Defense commanders wanted to protect the western United States from an enemy invasion, so they created prohibited zones where enemy aliens could not live or work. It included a sliver of land along the Pacific Ocean and some inland areas around military bases. Laura's father had to relocate.
It had a big impact on my father because he was farming rented land that was in the restricted area. So he had to give up his farming. The fact that he felt that he would not do anything against the United States and still had to be evacuated was hard.
Laura's family found a new place to rent. Ironically, on the other side of town that was not within the prohibited zone. Laura was only 7 years old at the time, so she didn't understand much about the stresses her parents were feeling.
Parents did not discuss a lot of things with their children. I know they were upset because they had to leave their home, but they didn't talk about it.
They thought that Mussolini's navy might attack the West Coast. Of course, Mussolini didn't have much of a navy.
Author Lawrence DeStasi helped write a book on Italian Americans during World War II. He says the West Coast general, John DeWitt, used his military powers in a much more draconian way than generals in other parts of the nation. It was DeWitt who commanded the incarceration of tens of thousands of Japanese Americans and the relocation of Italians on the West Coast. On the East Coast, Italians did have travel restrictions, but they weren't subject to curfew or mass relocation, says DeStasi.
The paranoia exhibited by the West Coast general, General John DeWitt. He was terrified that under his watch, the West Coast was going to be invaded. It never was, of course. It was partly hysteria, partly overkill, I think.
Because of DeWitt's relocation orders, Italians all around the Bay Area were in limbo, including thousands in the city of Alameda and Pittsburgh. To those who had to move, the dividing line between what was restricted or not seemed pretty arbitrary.
If you lived west of San Pablo Avenue, you had to move. If you lived east of San Pablo Avenue, you didn't have to worry about it.
Al Brizzoni grew up in Richmond on a 40-acre lettuce farm. He's now 92. But still remembers being 11 years old when the relocation orders came. It split his family up. He and his two younger siblings moved with his parents to Oakland. But his siblings, who were old enough to live by themselves and American-born, stayed in Richmond and worked the farm.
On weekends, my brothers would pick us up and we'd go back to where I was growing up.
Other Italians didn't have the money to rent homes nearby after being forced to relocate. Many moved in with friends or lived in substandard migrant housing. Brizzoni thought the whole ordeal was a big government mistake.
Most of the people came to this country because they were poor in Europe and they had a chance to accomplish something here. And that's why they would never go fight against the country because they were doing so well here.
Italians who worked on the coast also suffered. 80% of California's fishermen were Italian, and in 1942, their boats were seized by the Coast Guard. They were not allowed to fish on coastal waters. That is a story that Ken Borelli knows personally. It happened to his uncle, Girolamo Cantatore.
We called him Uncle Jim, but his name was Girolamo. And he lived in San Francisco and was a crab fisherman. And they would fish out of Fisherman's Wharf and go all up and down Northern California.
After losing access to his vessel and the water during the war, Borelli's uncle made a wooden replica of the boat. And Borelli still has it.
It's called the Teresa. You could see this back here. He wrote that.
The model boat looks handcrafted with love and an expert eye. It's about 2 feet wide with several deck levels.
This wire is very rusty. These are nails. He was a very meticulous person.
Borelli wishes he could have asked his uncle how he felt back then. His family never told him the details about whether his uncle was compensated or ever saw the boat again. But Borelli says the boat replica shows his uncle had idle hands and a mind that needed to be occupied.
Well, it was a yearning. It was a yearning to go back to sea.
Italian Americans didn't just endure forced relocation and lose property. Hundreds more were sent to prison camps, too. There, some slept in makeshift shelters, like tents, and were held along with Japanese and German detainees.
A lot of people mistakenly assume that Japanese Americans were the only ones affected by national security fears.
UC Santa Cruz historian Alice Yang says Italians and Germans living in the U.S. also had their civil liberties infringed upon. People were imprisoned for being Italian journalists, teaching the Italian language, or simply being veterans of World War I.
A lot of the assumptions about, you know, whether someone might be a security threat were based on prejudicial views of ethnicity. People who were part of organizations that were seen as promoting Italian pride. So in the pre-war period, that wasn't considered dangerous or subversive, but in the wartime era, right, having ethnic pride, if your pride was associated with an Axis power, could land you on one of these lists.
To be clear, De Stasi says a good portion of Italian immigrants in the U.S. at the time were supporters of Benito Mussolini, the Nazi-allied fascist leader of Italy. They may not have been in favor of what he did, but they liked that he was creating a new image for Italy.
Because they felt that he had finally put Italy on the map. He had gained some respect for Italy throughout the world. But that didn't mean that they were going to engage in any kind of anti-American activities.
High-profile Italian immigrants were also prey to the wartime security measures. New York-based opera singer Ezio Pinza was incarcerated without charge for 3 months. Baseball Hall of Famer Joe DiMaggio's mother, who lived in San Francisco, was arrested. Imprisoned Italians were moved from camp to camp around the country, many winding up in Fort Missoula, Montana. Then, quite sharply, the American government changed its tune about Italians. In October 1942, Attorney General Francis Biddle gave a speech touting the contributions of Italians in the United States Army.
Into the war against the Axis, they have sent their own sons. These Americans of Italian ancestry will help Italy again to become a free nation.
By the end of the month, the restrictions on Italian citizens would end.
To those who are affected by this change, I say tonight, you have met the test. Your loyalty to the democracy, which has given you this chance, you have proved, and proved well. Make the most of it. See to it that all Italians remain loyal.
Italians who were already in U.S. prisons stayed in camps for another year. But the relocated families in California, like Al Brazzoni and Laura Gallardi, they got to go home. In total, they'd endured 5 months of a relocation order and about 8 months of curfews and travel restrictions.
somebody finally realized they made a mistake, and they sent everybody home, because here they had the parents had to move away and they were drafting all their children.
Laura Gallardi says her dad lost his Brussels sprout farm near Santa Cruz, and it was hard to start all over again.
After they were able to go home, he never did go back to the farming. He went to work for others in the agricultural industry. As I look back, I think that we were much luckier than the Japanese, who were encamped and lost everything.
Many Italian immigrants in California were like Laura Gallardi's parents. They didn't feel a need to talk about hardships imposed on them to their kids or grandkids. But historian Alice Yang says there are important things to learn from this history. For one, not to judge whether someone is dangerous based on their ethnicity.
Especially when people are afraid, it is very easy for them to have irrational fears of entire groups, right? Based on race, religion, ethnicity.
Americans let wartime fears subvert civil rights during World War II, Yang says. And that's a lesson to learn from and never repeat.
Pauline Bartoloni reported that story for an episode of KQED's podcast, Bay Curious. And now we go down the California coast, where some people behind a well-known industry are speaking up about their working conditions.
This is the true story. True story.
Seven strangers picked to live in a loft.
I'm not embarrassed to admit, I love watching reality TV. The show that got me hooked was The Real World. And when it launched back in 1992, it was one of the first reality series on TV. Since then, the landscape of reality TV has just exploded. From Blind Dates.
Today on Blind Date.
Tiny Homes.
Check it out, you guys!
Tiny House time!
To Real Housewives.
I don't keep up with the Joneses. I am the Joneses.
But the success of the industry hasn't translated into stability for the people who make it. Megan Jamerson is a reporter with KCRW in Los Angeles. She's written about how some reality TV workers say they're overworked and underpaid, and she joins me now. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Bianca.
So what is the landscape of television production right now, and how is that affecting reality TV?
Well, I think this goes hand in hand with just the larger conversation we're hearing about a big contraction happening in Hollywood with the streamers and studios not green lighting as many projects. So while reality television, you know, is relatively cheap to make, they're seeing some major cutbacks in budgets. So there are fewer jobs to go around and, you know, shortened work schedules and longer hours for folks when you do get a job.
And why is reality TV cheaper to make?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you're not paying actors. For example, a single episode of reality television can cost anywhere between $100,000 and $500,000 to produce. In comparison with a scripted television show, you know, an experienced actor is being paid that per episode.
So in your reporting, you found that a lot of reality TV workers are struggling because they're working brutally long hours and getting poor pay. Who are some of the folks you talked with in your reporting, and what did they say?
Yeah, I spoke with more than a dozen workers, and pretty much across the board, no matter the position we're talking about, like PV's people were feeling the crunch of lower pay, longer hours, and just less work to go around. There wasn't a type of program where people are saying, oh yeah, it's really great here. Like everyone had some sort of specific challenge that they felt like was getting worse.
What are some of the specific things folks told you about their situation?
I think one of the big things that came up was pay. Over the last couple of years since the pandemic, folks were telling me that the rates that they're paid for the shows that they work on have gone down pretty drastically. you know, these folks are getting paid usually a weekly rate. It's not, they're not making an hourly rate or a salary. So for instance, I spoke with Laura Lee King Beckman, who was one of the few workers who was brave enough to go on the record with me. And she is a production manager. She was saying, prior to the pandemic, she was paid approximately $2,300 a week for work on a show. But recent job postings that she was seeing since the strike were about $1,400 a week. And I know that that sounds like a lot of money to some of us. But the important thing to remember is that, you know, these workers don't work full time year round. They have to get by in lean periods between jobs. And those lean periods are getting longer and longer. So her and others I spoke with said, you know, it's not enough to support their families, to pay for health insurance, which many of them don't get through the production companies that they work for, and just other basic necessities.
And Laura Lee King Beckman, she actually also told you about the show that she specifically worked for. It was the home improvement show Restored.
I'm Brett Waterman. Preservation's my passion.
I cannot wait to see what's under this mess.
You know why it's so cheap? Because it's built off the backs of people that are being exploited.
I mean, that's, she's not mincing words there.
Yeah, their anger was real, and the frustration, and just at the way that she sees not only herself, but others being treated. You know, she described specifically on that show, which was, like you said, a home renovation show. It was based out in the Inland Empire in Southern California. Just incredibly long hours, like working 16-hour days, not just Monday through Friday, but often work spilled over into the weekend, you know, getting texts at all hours of the day. And that went on for 5 months. That's not sustainable for anyone.
Yeah, another person you spoke to was Michelle. She works as a producer and asked to go by her middle name.
When you are working, and I mean nonstop, from the time you start in the morning until you shut down at night, it's a long haul. I mean, you don't feel like you can really even make yourself lunch. I think I made a grilled cheese one day and I felt bad about it. And you hope you can eat dinner before 9 p.m. and then you go to bed, wake up, sit back down, and it starts all over again.
I mean, not even being able to have a lunch break. I thought labor laws required that.
Yeah, the labor law when it comes to reality TV workers is a little murky because they fall under this interesting category of worker where you're almost on a weekly salary. So you're exempt from certain overtime laws, at least in the state of California. And so that's where workers like Michelle are saying unions could really help us, because in Hollywood, when you're a weekly salaried worker, unions are the one that come in and you know, put it into your contract that, okay, like if you go overtime, here are the specific rates and this is for how long. And, you know, you have to have X number of hours between shifts and that sort of thing. And these workers like Michelle and Laura Lee don't have that kind of protection.
Yeah, and it sounds like there are just limited options. Like basically they put up with it or they leave the industry altogether. And that's what Michelle said in this clip too.
Your options are suck it up, Buttercup, and get it done with a smile. Do the best job that you can. See the positive in the situation and, you know, you'll be invited back.
What Michelle's saying there is just what I kept hearing repeated over and over, is the power dynamics, of course, that a lot of workers in many different industries feel and are voicing concerns about these days. And it's just that fear of retaliation, that if you can't keep the pace, no matter what it becomes, that you are out of a job.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that really surprised me from your reporting was that these workers aren't unionized. And I mean, we heard so much about TV writers on strike last summer that I sort of assumed reality TV writers were a part of that. Are there any movements to improve these conditions and maybe unionize?
There's a group on the West Coast called the Nonfiction Coalition that's trying to drum up support and start to engage the Writers Guild in conversations. That's been kind of tough for them. And I know a lot of the efforts that they're working on have been very behind the scenes. Historically, the producers within reality TV, you know, attempted to unionize with the Writers Guild in the past. Unfortunately, that wasn't successful. But this industry includes so many different types of shows, it becomes difficult to, you know, create an umbrella type union contract to cover all the different types of work.
And what did the production companies have to say about any of this when you contacted them?
I contacted quite a few, and unfortunately, I did not hear back from anyone. I do think it's important to mention, though, that just as part of the shakeup that we're seeing in Hollywood over the last couple years is that production companies have been hit pretty hard as well by the shrinking budgets coming from streamers and studios. So we've seen, in LA at least, a number of small production companies close, do layoffs, and, you know, I think that's really clear sign that they're hurting as well. I think that a good thing to remember about that is that a lot of the shows that we're seeing today on streaming may have been made in, you know, in the previous years and were just held in the can, especially because studios and streamers were looking ahead and saw that the strike was coming. And so they sort of banked extra content and then cut way back on greenlighting new shows. And so that's why a lot of the workers that I talk to say, yeah, we had plentiful work during the pandemic, and then it dried up in January of 2023. And here we are a year later, and it's still quiet. But the viewers wouldn't know that because there's still things to watch.
Do you watch reality TV? And if so, what's your favorite show?
Ooh, I'd have to say The Great British Bake Off is one of my favorites.
I don't even like consider that reality TV because it's so wholesome. But yeah, that's definitely up there for me as well.
Yeah.
Megan Jamerson is a reporter with KCRW in Los Angeles. Thanks for talking with us today, Megan.
Thanks so much.
Next week on the California Report magazine, home. It's a word that has a lot of meaning. For some of us, it might be where we were born or where we grew up. For others, it's less of a place and more of a feeling. Immigration policies and how they're enforced here in the U.S. can complicate this idea of home even more. When someone is deported and forced to go back to, quote, their home country, it can sometimes be a place they don't even remember or never even knew.
I have no ties to a country I was born in. I left when I was 1 year old and don't speak the language, don't know anybody.
Poon Yu's family escaped a genocide in Cambodia, and he spent part of his youth living in Southern California. After joining a gang for protection and committing a violent crime, he served 25 years in California prisons. Then he was deported.
Oh, my heart just started pounding. I'm like, this is it. This is the moment they're going to take me. And an ICE agent came, and he's the one who said, hey, you're headed to the airport. They are shipping me now.
On next week's show, we'll have Poon's story of leaving the only country he knew and how he's setting up a new life in a place his parents escaped. And that's it for the California Report magazine. Our senior editor is Victoria Malione, with additional editing from Pauline Bartoloni. Susie Rocho is our director-producer, with support from Jessica Carissa. Our engineer is Brendan Willard. Lucen Mendel is our intern. I'm Bianca Taylor, in for Sasha Coca. This is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.